European leaders are meeting in Brussels to try to hammer out an agreement to deal with Europe's financial crisis. There are several critical issues that need to be addressed. What to do about Greece's enormous debt, how to prevent the crisis from spreading to other countries, how to increase the bailout fund, and how to create confidence in the system. That's a tall order and one that has worldwide implications. Europe's debt crisis has rattled markets here in the United States. We asked Mauro Guillen to give us a primer and get us up to speed on the debt crisis in Europe. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, also director of the Lauder Institute, and that's a research and teaching program on management and international relations, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Let's go back to the beginning, and when I say primer or primer, I really mean that. Why was the Eurozone established?
Well, the Eurozone was established about 11 years ago, in 1999, and European leaders at the time wanted to accomplish essentially three things. So very quickly, number one was to eliminate all of the problems with, bouncing currencies and to create a foundation for more trade and for more economic growth in Europe. And, of course, they also were thinking about perhaps bringing the continent closer together through the creation of a currency. Remember, in the U.S., we did not have a common currency at the beginning. It took quite a while. And it took even longer to have the Federal Reserve. So that was the plan, but of course the plan has not gone exactly according to plan.
Which is why you are here. Now, 17 countries out of the 27 in the Eurozone use the euro, yes? But 10 do not.
That is correct, and that's one of the problems. I don't think it's the biggest problem, but it is certainly one of the problems, that some of the countries have opted over the last few years not to join the euro, the common currency.
Now, there are problems today, but would you say that there was the sort of heyday of the Eurozone? Were there years when people were saying, gosh, this is working?
Absolutely. So I would say between 2003 and 2007, 2008, so just before the financial crisis, everybody around the world, here in the United States, we thought that everything was going according to plan. And so did the Europeans. The euro was gaining ground relative to the dollar. More and more people were, accumulating reserves, putting money aside in euros. So, during the boom times, everything was going according to plan.
And were the boom times the problem or create the problem that Europe is dealing with today?
Absolutely. And, we could go into details about the real estate market. We could go into details about the banks. But the problems of today essentially go back, the origins go back to the boom years, just as here in the United States.
Well, you're from Spain, and I know there was a real estate, or probably still is a real estate boom. Well, maybe it's a bust now in Spain, but that was one of the issues, not unlike the United States, driving the economy.
Absolutely. Not all over Europe, though. So in Germany or in Portugal, there was no real estate bubble. But in Ireland, in the UK, in Spain, in Greece, all of those countries are now suffering the fallout from the real estate boom.
And then there were countries that borrowed money that now they can't pay back, right?
That's the
other side, right?
That is the problem. The crisis has mutated. So it has started in the real estate sector. It started with unemployment. It started with GDP, gross domestic product going down. And now the problem is that governments are deeply into debt on this side of the Atlantic, and especially in Europe. And this is the problem we're confronting right now.
So let's talk about Greece, because that seems to be the point of a lot of contention here. How did Greece get itself in such a big mess?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it is a great question, because obviously people are asking, how come that such a tiny country is hijacking the European Union and pretty much the global economy? And Greece, to begin with, was a country that wasn't keeping track of what was going on that well. Or some people say they were actually lying about the true nature of their problems. And this was a country that was borrowing heavily. Mm. And the question then is, why were lenders giving Greece all of that money, especially German and French banks? And the answer is that people were fooled by the idea that the euro was safe. And they thought, well, we're lending them in euros, and they have to return the money in euros, so we're fine. There's no currency risk, right? But, of course, they overestimated the ability of Greece to weather a storm such as the one that unraveled in 2008.
But do you think there's evidence that there was lying going on, that the banks were hiding their problems from outsiders?
The government in Greece, and a little bit in other countries, right? All governments like to cheat a little bit here and there. But it seems as if the Greek government over the last 10 years or so took this kind of statistical misreporting to a new level. And that in part then misled the banks and the lenders, which, by the way, I think they also made some foolish assumptions mm-hmm. about the ability of Greece as a country to pay back.
But as you mentioned, Greece has a GDP of something like $310 billion, mm-hmm. not a huge economy, and yet it has created such problems for Europe.
It's a fraction of a 1 percentage point of the global economy.
Right.
It's the one of the smallest economies in Europe. Only Luxembourg and a couple of other European Union members are smaller. But it is causing a lot of trouble because it is a member of the euro, so it puts at risk the entire scheme, right, monetary scheme. Mm-hmm. And number two, it is problematic because, as I mentioned earlier, the French and the German banks in particular are up to their necks with Greek debt. Mm-hmm. So if Greece were to default, in other words, wouldn't be able to meet its obligations, then banks in other parts of Europe would suffer immensely. To the point that they would need to ask for more money, the banks, to recapitalize themselves, especially German banks. And the second most hit banks would be the French banks.
Now, Greece was bailed out in 2010, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes, in May
of last year. Where did that money go? I mean, what happened to that?
Well, you see, when the economy is not growing, when unemployment keeps on going up, government expenditures need to go up, right? Unemployment subsidies and so on and so forth. And so the money just wasn't enough for the country to survive such a prolonged recession. And then all of the austerity measures have in many ways made the recession even worse. This last spring or summer, there was another bailout program approved for Greece of about the same mm-hmm. the same amount, about mm-hmm. 100 billion euros, which is, you have to multiply by, 1.3 or so, right, in U.S. dollars, which is a huge amount
yes.
for such a small country.
But there have been strikes, there have been riots, demonstrations. I mean, it sounds as if the political system in Greece is in chaos.
Well, of course, there's 130,000 tons of garbage that is going uncollected in Greece because the garbage collectors are on strike. The whole country is essentially protesting against conditions imposed by the European Union. To bail the country out. And that's another very important piece of the puzzle, which is there another way of essentially overcoming the situation in Europe? The European leaders have chosen so far, right, to bail out countries, Greece, then Ireland, then Portugal. Now they're changing their approach and they're saying, let's have the banks, the bondholders,
yes.
right, share some of the burden. And this is what the meeting that is going on as we speak in Brussels is all about.
So that would sort of share, at least go to the banks first and see what you can work out, and then governments would be asked to pony up in a sense?
Well, yes. I mean, essentially, when you have a country that cannot pay, you can either give the money to the country and then the right. country pays the lenders, or you can tell the country, we're going to pardon you. We're going to let you just pay 60 cents on the dollar or 60 cents on the euro, right? But then the bondholders are going to take a hit.
Right.
And if the bondholders are banks, then that's problematic because then maybe the banks will become undercapitalized and that could spread the problems, right? So then the issue now is, okay, if we pardon the Greeks, right, for a little bit of the money, then we're going to have to do something about the French and the German banks in particular. And this is what all of the sure. negotiations are all about right now.
Because it sets a precedent, right? If you're going to do one for one country, you're going to have to figure out going to do something similar to the other country.
Absolutely. We haven't talked about the markets.
No.
And, of course, the markets are thirsty for blood. And when they see that there's a bailout, then they think, well, then let's now tempt Italy, right? Let's probe into Italy. Let's see if we can make some money over there. And by betting against, Italian government debt. And, of course, given the mess, the political mess in Italy, that is kind of a good target right now. So, yes, you have to draw the line, and that's why they're obviously trying to set up a firewall. But it's very difficult.
Right.
And you mentioned the word confidence and credibility
yes.
in your introduction.
Yes.
This is what's missing right now, credibility and confidence.
Because you've got, obviously, I mean, these are countries that are, in a sense, tied together for trade reasons, for, in 17 cases, because they have a shared currency. But and actually, NPR had a really interesting story this morning about the big egos that are also, you know, sitting around a table and trying to figure out what's going to be good for their country and then what's going to be good for the region.
Absolutely. That's the other problem, that what is good for Europe may not be good for individual countries. And then keep in mind another big issue here, which is that the 17 member countries that have a common currency, they cannot just print money to pay their debt down, which is what the U.S. has been doing, which is what the U.K. has been doing. They don't have that advantage because they committed to the common currency. And that's what makes the situation right now more complicated for a country like Greece or for a country like Italy or for a country like Portugal.
Because they literally cannot print money.
They cannot print money, just as the U.S. has been doing over the last couple of years and just as the U.K. has been doing. Right?
Now, you said that there is talk about having countries turning to banks and seeing how much they can get from a bank. But what bank would lend to Greece? And I know that banking is extremely complicated, but what bank would give Greece money?
Well, there are investors out there, including banks, who would be willing to purchase Greek debt.
Exactly.
But the Greeks don't want to buy it, you know, to issue those bonds, because investors are demanding very high interest rates, 25%, 30%, right?
Because it's a risky...
Right. So this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the investors demand very high rates, then, you know, the Greek government says, no, we don't want to do it. As they move closer and closer to the cliff, then the rates go even higher and higher. So it becomes a self-fulfilling process. And this is why it's so important that this week in Europe, they bring this self-fulfilling, you know, negative feedback loop kind of process to an end. They create a solution. They come up with a solution that will bring this entire process to an end.
But is that also why yesterday a meeting was canceled? I mean, that the solution that I guess is going to be painful is something that people actually don't want to do, even if they must do it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there's also, as you mentioned earlier, disagreement. By far the most important country in all of these conversations is Germany. And as you know, within Germany, there are some parts of the country that are in favor of doing whatever it takes to save the euro. But there are other sectors of German society and the German businesses that are against it. So Merkel has this big problem in her hands, right, which is to navigate the very complicated German politics.
We're almost having a break here, but I can understand how Germany, that looked like it kind of behaved itself and didn't spend too much, and being in a position to have to bail out countries that were, frankly, irresponsible, I could see why that might rankle somebody in Germany.
Absolutely. Some voters are reacting in precisely the way that you just mentioned.
And Merkel has to figure out how to... I guess, either find some kind of consensus or come to some kind of decision that both helps her country but also helps the euro, helps the
Absolutely.
Eurozone.
Absolutely.
Well, let's take that short break, and we are talking about Europe and its debt crisis, and talking with Mauro Guillen, and he's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, director of the Lauder Institute, a research and teaching program on management and international relations. He's also a professor of sociology at Penn, and joining us today on Radio Times as we deconstruct the debt crisis in Europe, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University offers over 150 undergraduate and graduate programs, including degrees in pharmaceutical product development and special education, and research opportunities like the DNA Discussion Project, Advancing Intercultural Communication. More details are available at wcupa.edu. That's online at wcupa.edu.
WHYY congratulates the talented young filmmakers who won our first ever Youth Media Awards. Thanks to all who submitted videos. Choosing from the more than 150 entries was a huge challenge for our judges. Look for the winning videos at whyy.org/HamiltonCommons. They'll also air on our Y Arts TV channel. Young storytellers, keep it up. The Youth Media Awards wants to see what you've got again next year. WHYY and the Hamilton Public Media Commons, giving creative young minds the recognition they deserve.
This week in This American Life, a police officer, Adrian Schoolcraft, decides that he's going to wear a secret tape recorder on the job. He records roll calls where cops are told that their boss wanted more tickets issued, or they'd be disciplined.
He wants at least 3 seatbelts, 1 cell phone.
Adrian Schoolcraft also records police being told not to file reports on the worst crimes to help their numbers. But then, the police go after Adrian Schoolcraft this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. EU leaders have been meeting in Brussels to develop a comprehensive plan to deal with the debt crisis and so far have failed to reach an agreement. It is a complicated issue, and we are talking about how this crisis got started, what the options are that are being discussed, the future of the EU, and I should say we do want to talk about the impact on the United States and perhaps the role of China as well. And again, Mauro Guillen is our guest, and he's a professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. And again, there is no question that is off limits or too dumb for this hour of Radio Times. I've been asking some of those as well. 1-888-477-9499. You told me when we came in, and I wasn't watching the news for the first hour of the show today, that there were actually a fist fight in the Italian Parliament. What are they fighting about in Italy?
Well, they're fighting about the austerity measures. So Berlusconi, the prime minister, is in a weakened situation and has been in that situation for a few months. And Italy has been falling behind in terms of making adjustments so that they can meet their obligations. And Italy has one of the biggest debt burdens, equivalent to that of Greece, once you adjust for the size of the economy. So Italy is one of the largest government debtors in the world. They really owe a lot of money. And as I mentioned, they're falling behind in terms of making adjustments, making sure that they're going to have enough money. So now the markets are essentially focusing their attention on Italy. Mm-hmm. In the last few months, they focused on the smaller economies. And this is really dangerous, because one thing is that Greece or Portugal gets into trouble, and quite another is that Italy, which is one of the largest economies in the world, one of the top 10, gets into trouble.
And then you add just the personality of Berlusconi and, his whole track record there. And you can see how the sort of politics of an individual country then plays out in this debt crisis. Yeah,
absolutely. That is the other problem. You have 17 countries being members of the euro, each of them with a different history, each of them with a different prime minister or president, each of them with different preferences as to how to get, to a solution. Mm-hmm.
Are we also talking about the fact that these countries were affected by the bubble and then, of course, the recession that has affected the United States and many other parts of the world, that the revenue's not coming into the government? And we know these are governments that have lots of programs for their citizens, that they're being squeezed that way as well?
Absolutely. Recessions essentially mean that governments need to spend more money on unemployment benefits, on retraining workers, and so on and so forth, and they also collect less money.
Right.
So it is a very serious situation, and of course a big debate, as you know, among economists is what do we do? Because by far the best way to get out of a debt problem is to get the economy growing again. It's
yes.
The same debate that we're seeing here in the United States between Democrats and Republicans. The Republicans want to fix the debt problem first. The Democrats want to get the economy going first. The same debate is playing out in Europe right now.
You mentioned the fact that in this country we can print money. Not everybody likes that, but it's something that we can do. They can't do that with the euro. What are some of the parallels you see between this country as we deal with our own economic financial problems and what's going on in Europe?
Well, we're dealing with the consequences of a real estate bubble.
Mm-hmm.
We have high unemployment, just as the Europeans do. We have an economy that is not growing, while some parts of the global economy, China, Brazil, India, are growing very, very quickly at 8, 9, 10%. So we're falling behind. And, on top of all of that, the banks in the United States, just as the banks in Europe, I think they still carry on their books,
mm-hmm.
right, a lot of bad debt, bad assets. And so we haven't cleaned up the mess yet. It's going to take a while. Of course, at the same time, we have families also deep into debt. They're trying to reduce that debt. We have corporations also in trouble because they can't sell enough, so they don't create jobs, but they also have a lot of debt that they accumulated during the boom years. I already talked about the banks and I talked about the government.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's deeply into debt in this part of the world. Not in other parts of the world, but in this part of the world. So we're struggling.
Right. And in bank, did banks in Europe do the kind of risky things that banks in this country have done that created the financial crisis?
Oh, absolutely.
In any ways?
Absolutely. And we have some very colorful examples of that. You know, one of the French banks, you know, twice in a row, actually, a trader, you know, was making bets and they lost billions of dollars. More recently, outside of the European Union, but still in Europe, a Swiss bank had the same problem. Several of the German banks also were betting strongly on continuing, you know, high prices in real estate in the U.S. So they bought all of those toxic, you know, securities as well. So the European banks also, you know, try to, you know, participate in the orgy, right, taking place here on this side of the Atlantic.
It's a well-chosen word.
Up until 3 or 4 years ago. And not nearly to the same extent, but almost as much as the U.S. banks.
Which is why we see the U.S. stock market, which has been very volatile, but sort of reacting to what's going on in Europe.
Absolutely. You know, financial markets in the world have become very interconnected. It's very difficult to ignore now something that is going on in other parts of the world. But most importantly, the U.S. economy is affected by whatever goes in Europe in a direct way. Europe continues to be the most important market for American companies. It's not China. It's not Latin America. It's Europe. If consumers in Europe don't buy or reduce their spending, that means fewer American-made goods. And also American firms manufacturing goods in Europe will make smaller profits. And so their shareholders back here in the United States will, you know, get you know, fewer, smaller dividends. So the impact on the real economy, the so-called real economy, is huge because Europe is a big consumer market. And then on top of that, you have the financial problems that, as we know, in this age of globalization, they spread from one country to the other within a few hours. It doesn't take more than a few hours.
You mentioned India, Brazil, China. I mean, these are three countries that are actually doing pretty well in today's marketplace. What role do you think China is playing? And, of course, China owns a lot of U.S. debt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one of the possibilities that is being discussed in Europe is that China could, instead of investing so much of its surpluses in U.S. debt, it could perhaps buy European debt. And the rumors are that what the Chinese want is to be recognized as a market economy, which means that they will be treated more fairly in World Trade Organization disputes and all of that. Mm-hmm. So it seems as if the Chinese want to get something out of this. And keep in mind, the Chinese right now have a lot of money to spend. So last year, they accumulated money, right, because of their surpluses. They export much more than they import at a rate of about $1.3 billion per day.
Per day?
Per day, which means that over the course of our conversation here today, over the course of 1 hour, they will have accumulated $50 million in just 1 hour. That's the pace at which the Chinese are accumulating money because they export much more than they import.
And the challenge for them is, what do they do with all this money,
exactly.
right?
Exactly. And right now, it's actually a very difficult decision to make because there's so much uncertainty, so much volatility, so much risk. But they need to do something with that money because that money is in foreign currency. It's in dollars. It's in euros. They're putting some of it in gold, and that's why, you know, the price of gold is going up. But they need to find securities to buy. And, of course, up until now, government securities were, you know, the way to go. And then the issue right now, again, in Europe is, can we persuade the Chinese to give us a little money? You know?
Well, that's interesting. Now, I mean, it sounds like that might be something attractive for the Chinese. How would that affect the U.S., or would it? Maybe they're just making so much money it wouldn't affect
the U.S.? Well, it might reduce the appetite for U.S. Treasury bills. But right now, U.S. Treasury bills are, I think, a better investment than European bonds, except for German bonds, right? So I don't think it's going to have a negative impact on the U.S. Now, from the Chinese perspective, they would prefer to buy assets, other assets like companies. But neither the U.S. nor the Europeans want to sell companies to the Chinese. They would prefer that, right? But given that they can't, for political reasons mainly, then I think they will be at some point persuaded to buy more European debt and to hopefully continue buying U.S. debt. We really need them.
Well, and that's Mauro Guillen, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about a whole host of things, largely the debt crisis in Europe, and that raises all sorts of fascinating and potentially troublesome questions. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, directs the Lauder Institute, a research and teaching program on management and international relations, and also a professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, and there's a lot of sociology when it comes to the issue of finance. And we are taking calls here at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me ask you about, we've talked about Greece, we've talked about Italy, we've talked about Germany. I'd like to talk about France and the kind of role that it plays. And I was reading, I think it was in the New York Times, that France has a lot of money, I think, invested in Italian, I guess, the Italian economy, yes?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Italian government debt in particular.
Government debt, yes.
Absolutely. So the French banks have, it's particularly the French banks, and some of them have close ties to the government, but it's essentially the banks, and most of them are very large. Mm-hmm. And they do have some exposure to whatever goes on in Ireland or Portugal or Greece, but by far their biggest exposure is to Italy, to the point, just to give you a figure, that if Italian debt were to lose all of its value tomorrow, which is unlikely, but just assume that for the sake of argument, the French banks would lose 30% of their capital, 30% of their capital. Now, a more likely scenario is that, let's say, Italian government debt, might lose, 20 or 30% of its value. Well, that would mean still a major, consequence for French banks, about 10% of the capital. That would mean that they wouldn't be able to comply with regulatory levels of, the capital that they need to have on hand. So it is a very serious situation, and everybody's concerned about France. And as you know, the country itself is also trying to adjust. So that's the exposure to Italy. But France was on the verge of losing its AAA rating a few weeks ago, and they're still under pressure. They could be, the next target of the markets.
Do you think the Eurozone, the European zone, do you think it will fall apart over this? Or what do you, as you look ahead, how do you see these serious issues getting resolved, if at all?
Yeah, well, I think there's two ways of answering that question. The first way is the hopeful way, which is that it is in nobody's interest, the Europeans or the Americans or the Chinese, it's in nobody's interest that the European common currency falls apart, because that would create so much chaos, so much volatility. And remember, Europe is about 25% of the global economy, right? We don't want 25% of a part of the global economy that is very heavily interconnected with the rest of the world to go into a 1930s style crisis, right? I mean, because of this. Now, the more realistic answer, though, is that unless in Brussels today or this week or next week, there is a firm commitment to address the problems with Greece and also the problems, with Italy and the other peripheral countries, the southern countries, we could get into that type of situation. Mm. This is becoming a cliffhanger. It's like one day there's a solution, another day there's no solution. One day the markets, go well here in the United States, they go up. Right. Another day they go down. We need to put an end to this, but it seems as if the politicians, are not up to the job right
now. Well, that's interesting and has a kind of familiar ring to me. But at the same time, I guess there are short-term fixes, and perhaps that's what's been going on for the last couple of years. And then there's the big fix that nobody wants, but perhaps would at least address some of the problems we've been talking about.
Absolutely. And so far, we've been trying to use Band-Aids here and there. Mm-hmm. Some very expensive Band-Aids. We're talking about $100 billion, right, or more per Band-Aid. But a series of those, like five or six that have been tried over the last 2 years or so, they have failed to pacify the markets, right? And so we're still confronting a big problem.
I was reading about the European Financial Stability Facility has something like $600 billion on hand, but actually would need $2.178 trillion to address the problem, as a stark example of, I guess, the hole in the middle between 600 and what's actually needed.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So this is the fund that European countries have put together. And most experts say that it's not enough. There's some difference of opinion as to how large it should be. One of the topics that is being discussed in Brussels right now is precisely, how much more money will need to be added to that fund.
And so that's what that's another thing they have to think about, right?
Absolutely. And if Italy gets into trouble in a serious way, then we know that the fund will be, way too small for that kind of a big problem.
And your definition of Italy getting into trouble, what would that be? And then we'll get to our callers.
Well, that would be that essentially the markets start asking Italy for very high interest rates so that they can continue to refinance their debt. And it could get to a point that the Italian government then says, we're broke, so what are we going to do about this? And that would be a disaster because Italy is, of course, 20, 30 times bigger than Greece.
Let me get, looks like Karen from Gulf Mills to join us on Radio Times. And Karen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
We were just in Greece a couple weeks ago for 3 weeks.
Good for you.
And talked with taxi cab drivers about how they saw the situation and why the people in Greece are so angry, because clearly the people in Athens are really struggling. And I guess we got this from two different cab drivers, and I'd be interested in your guests' comments on them. One was that the Greek government, some of the people over the last 15 or 20 years who have been in charge of the government, have made a lot of money. And they are getting off scot-free while the Greek people are having to deal with the debt crisis, much like our banking situation was a few years ago. The other comment was that they feel like the people in the Eurozone who are making the decisions about what goes forward, some of them are wanting the Greek economy to go flat so that they can come in then and make some good investments and, again, make a lot of money that the Greek people won't get to see. And I'd be interested in your guests' comments on those two.
Yeah, me
thoughts.
Too, Karen. And I always say to people, talk to cab drivers if you want to know what's going on. Let me see what our guest has to say.
Yes, Karen, yeah. And especially in Athens, you should talk to cab drivers because you have to spend so much time right in traffic,
getting from one place
to the other. I think there is an element of truth in both of both comments. So obviously, over the last 10 years, the boom years, many people have made a ton of money, including some politicians or, former politicians who then, rotated into the private sector. So that is beyond the, the doubt. And the second issue, of course, is also true. That is to say that at some point, assets in Greece could become, a bargain.
Sure.
That might be interpreted by some as being good for the country, others as being bad, meaning that, they're getting them for a very low price. I think the frustration is real. It's not just in Greece. It's everywhere. And that's why we have the Occupy Wall Street, and that's why we have all of these movements all over the industrialized world right now. The confidence in politicians, confidence in bankers, of course, confidence in just in general leaders is at all-time lows. And, there's a lot of thinking and rethinking that we need to do, including, I think, also the population itself, because we were talking about culture earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are still in this mindset that, the government can fix everything and that you can rely on the government for everything. And, there's a limit to that. So I think everybody's expectations need to be readjusted, because this crisis is not just a downturn in the business cycle. It's a major structural discontinuity. There's a before and an after. And we're just right now in the middle of, if I may put it this way, Act 3 of this drama, right?
It's and how many in acts US. In the drama do you think?
Well, we'll see, right? I mean, there's no limit, right? There could be a fourth or a fifth. But the crisis has become now a very different thing from what it was in 2008. And, a lot of people are suffering. Unemployment is way too high, especially among the young.
Karen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation and our callers. We invited Mauro Guillon to join us today on Radio Times. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, director of the Lauder Institute, where he's been involved in research and training on management and international relations. And he's also a professor of sociology. And we are talking about the debt crisis in Europe, what it means for Europe, for the world economy, and certainly for the U.S. as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Hill School supports WHYY. A private co-educational boarding school located in Pottstown, The Hill School provides students in grades 9 through 12 with the essentials for college, careers, and life in a diverse learning and living community. Hill students come from across the country and around the world. They are athletes, artists, friends, classmates, and future leaders. An open house is October 29th at 9:30 a.m. Information is available at 610-326-1000 or online at thehill.org.
The country's in recession, unemployment rates are unacceptably high, foreign affairs are at best uncertain, and a growing list of critically important social service initiatives are wanting for support. Yet, because of your interest in public media, WHYY continues to grow its market share, its revenue top lines, and positive net income. I'm Bill Morazzo, and I'm so very proud as your CEO to thank all of you who expressed your financial support during our recent FM drive. Thank you.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll look at the new arms race for drones. Everyone from Hezbollah to Mexican drug cartels wants them. Also, the World Series. Is it possible that the Cards lost a game because of a bungled phone call? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Mauro Guillen about the debt crisis in Europe and why it matters, not just to people living in Europe, but to everyone around the world. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I find it interesting that you are a professor of sociology, because if there's one thing we've learned about our financial system is that it relies on trust and transparency and confidence that plays such an important role in the kind of financial interconnected world that we live in.
Absolutely. Trust and confidence are everything in financial markets. If the people who have money cannot trust the people who need the money, then financial markets will never work. So it is a sociological problem as well as a political problem and an economic problem. Absolutely.
But one senses that there is deep mistrust of the system. I mean, just sort of a systemic mistrust.
Yes, I think what happened in 2008 and 2009 and what continues to happen in some parts of the world right now, especially in Europe, with the new revelations about what the banks are doing and some of their losses and so on and so forth, just adds to the public's perception that there's something rotten in the Kingdom of Denmark here. Something really, really bad has been going on. And the problem is that rebuilding trust and confidence takes a long time.
Yeah.
Takes a very long time.
And you have to almost prove it every day, in a way, right, to bring it back. We got an email question. How will the euro crisis affect commodities, things like oil, wheat, if the EU does not work out their problems with Greece and Italy? This is Eric from Philadelphia.
Well, two ways to answer that question. One is if the crisis in Europe makes the recovery more difficult, the economic recovery worldwide, or if we get into a double-dip recession, then we know that commodity prices go down because demand for oil, demand for metals, demand for all of those things goes down.
Right.
So that's one area, one way of answering the question. The other, of course, is it will just add to the turmoil and to the volatility. So what we could see, though, is that some of those commodities, especially gold, could become a safe haven for investors. So one has to be careful. I mean, for certain things such as oil or such as, copper, the effect would be, declining prices. But for some other, precious metals in particular, it could become like a reserve asset, right? More so than it already is, if the volatility continues.
Let me get, looks like Gail from media to join us on Radio Times. And Gail, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, good
there.
Morning. Thanks
good morning.
For taking my call.
You're very welcome.
The question I have is, if the Eurozone is in such turmoil, why does the Euro still seem to be standing so strong against the dollar? Like, the value of the Euro is still going up against the value of the dollar, and that has me a little confused.
That's a great question, Gail. Go ahead.
That is a wonderful question, and let me answer it in the following way, which is, one is that the European Central Bank has raised interest rates over the last couple of years, just by a little bit, but it has raised interest rates, which then means that euro-denominated assets become more attractive to investors than dollar-denominated assets. That's one reason. A second reason is that the United States, as you know, has a big trade deficit. Okay, the technical term is a big deficit in the current account, right? Because we import more than we export. That puts downward pressure on the dollar. Now, you might be wondering, how about Europe? Well, actually, it turns out that the Eurozone, the 17 countries taken as a whole, have balanced trade. They import and export equal amounts. Why? Because they have some countries like Germany that export a lot and they don't import as much. And then, of course, they have some countries like Portugal or Ireland or Spain or Greece or Italy that import more than they export. But at the end of the year, it all balances out. So there's no downward pressure on the euro. So you're absolutely correct. It's a paradox. How come that they have all of these problems with the euro and yet the euro is relatively strong, right, yeah, lately when compared to the dollar. And it's because, I think, from my point of view, mainly interest rates and that the fact that the Europeans don't have a trade deficit, which we do.
Gail, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Is there anything you think the U.S. should or can do as Europe deals with this debt crisis besides stand on the sidelines?
Well, I think it is in the best interest of the United States as a country, of the U.S. consumer, of U.S. investors, of U.S. banks, that the problem in Europe gets resolved. U.S. banks are exposed to the extent, and we don't know what extent that is, that they have insured some of these government debts through the famous credit default swaps.
Yes.
The American consumer has a stake because, your job may be on the line if Europe doesn't buy enough U.S. goods. And the U.S. as a country, I think, is, interested in a resolution to this problem because we have nothing to gain from a European disaster. We have everything to gain from a vibrant and financially sound Europe.
Let me get Jim from New Brunswick to join our conversation. And Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
My question the professor just touched on a little bit. Just like AIG sold all this credit default swap insurance before the last crisis, who actually is holding the bag now? Who has sold the insurance on Italy and Greece?
It's a good question, Jim. Yeah, go ahead, Maura.
Yes, Jim, the problem is that we don't know. Maybe the CIA knows, but we really don't know. And the reason for that is that, as you know, the CDSs and all of these hedges are mostly the so-called over-the-counter instruments. And so there's no central registry. This is, by the way, one of the major reasons why we had a financial crisis in this country in the first place back in 2008. So just to give you some numbers, it seems as if the exposure, global exposure, not just U.S. banks or U.S. insurance companies, to Greece might be, I'm going to give you a very wide range, between $5 billion and $100 billion, depending on the source. Okay, so depending on whom you listen to, they give you a different estimate. If it's $100 billion just to Greece, that's a huge number. And I would guess that maybe 20, 30, 40% of that is U.S. banks or other U.S. Actors. And, of course, this counterparty risk and these CDSs, the credit default swaps, could magnify, could exacerbate, right, make the whole thing even bigger, right? For the same reason that when Lehman Brothers went past in 2008, all of the counterparty risk just made the whole situation much, much worse.
In fact, preparing for the show, I was thinking about Lehman Brothers. I mean, one which was, 3 years ago, I guess. One senses some parallels there, yes?
Well, yes, except that what most people say is that so there are parallels, yes, but the magnitude of the problem won't be as large, which is good news.
Yes.
So maybe it's only 20%. Maybe it's only 25%. I don't think it's going to be more than that. Some people even say that it's no more than 5% of the kind of impact that Lehman Brothers had if Europe went past. For this reason, I mean, you still have to deal with a problem in Europe, right, of unemployment and of the economy not growing. But in terms of the immediate impact because of the counterparty risk, some people say it could be as small as just 5% of what Lehman was. Wow. But some people say it could be 25%, 30%. So it won't be as bad. But it will be bad enough to just add more, problems to the equation here.
Well, we are talking about the debt crisis in Europe and talking with Mauro Guillen, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So here's a really basic question. So there are 27 member states in the European zone, 17 that use the euro, 10 obviously that don't have the euro. As this euro crisis or debt crisis goes on, are those countries that don't use the euro, are they in any way off the hook or not implicated in this crisis?
Well, they're partially off the hook. They're off the hook, of course, to the extent that they have their own currency. Wow. They may have debt problems, but they can print money. They have more flexibility. They're not inside a straitjacket right now. But at the same time, they are exposed to this because, you see, take the example of the UK.
Right.
For the UK, by far, its most important foreign market for their exports is the rest of Europe. So if something goes bad in Europe, then that affects the UK, that affects Denmark, that affects Sweden, the other countries that haven't adopted the euro as a currency. So there's no way to run. And that's why David Cameron, if you remember, about a week ago or a few days ago, got involved in the discussions to the point that actually Sarkozy, the French president, got really upset.
I noticed that, right? Yes.
So Cameron thought, well, we're also affected by this. We would like to participate in the decision-making. And the French president reacted very negatively to that. Mm.
Which maybe gets us back to these colliding egos, but also the uniqueness, I guess, of every country as well.
Absolutely. And look, I mean, what you need to remember is that this is a unique experiment in human history.
Right.
So we have 17 countries plus the other 10 who are in, you know, essentially trying to create out of nothing, right, a common economic and financial and monetary entity. This has never been done before. So it's pure experimentation. And again, as you mentioned at the beginning, for 10 years, it mm-hmm. seems as if it was working just fine. But now we're seeing that there were some limitations.
So if you were asked to go to Brussels and advise the EU leaders that are financial leaders that are sitting around the table, not that they would take your advice, what would you tell them?
Yes, I would love to go to Brussels for another reason. For this one, I would hesitate. But
they have very good beer, right?
What they need to do, I think, and this is for the sake of Europe, but also for the sake of the entire global economy, is to bite the bullet and realize it's going to cost us a lot of money. Some people are going to be unhappy. They may not vote for us at the next election. But you really need to, right now, persuade Greece and Italy and all of the other countries in trouble, on the one hand, mm-hmm. and the banks, on the other, who mm-hmm. are the big players on the lending side, to come to the table and to say, okay, we're going to agree to a haircut, meaning a reduction in the amount that these countries owe, and then come up with a plan to recapitalize the banks, you know, at least those that will need some extra right. money to operate after that.
And for people living in those countries, they have to live with some austerity measures? I mean, is that the price that's
they will.
Paid?
They will. But most importantly, I think what populations in Europe need to think about is how they can become, again, their economies can become competitive. The Germans have done that over the last mm-hmm. 10 years very painfully. But most of the other countries in Europe haven't made the adjustments, more in terms of how they work, how hard they work, how intelligent they work.
You mean literally how hard they work at their jobs?
At their jobs. So how productive they are. Because, and this is a problem here also in the United States, the global economy doesn't stop just because we have a problem. And China and India and Brazil and other countries are making a lot of progress. So we need to do our homework, and it's not something that we can fix in a year or two. It's something that will require a steady effort over, you know, 10, 15 years.
Let me get, it looks like Alex from Mount Airy to join our conversation. And Alex, go ahead, you're on the air.
I wonder if you could compare how people in neighborhoods from day to day in Europe are being sustained maybe by their safety nets as compared to here, where the major safety net seems to be people with pensions and Social Security who are taking care of family and neighbors, and volunteers are keeping people going while the governments and the economies recover.
Alex, it's a good question, and I'll see what our guest has to say.
Yeah, that's a big difference between Europe and the United States. It's more of a social safety net that is funded by the government. Now, of course, this is adding to the problem in some ways, but it is at least reducing the pain in the short run. Now, remember that in Europe, it happens in the United States, but it's mainly a European problem. Unemployment is essentially a problem among the young. So the unemployment rate in many of these countries among young people is like 45%, 50%.
45%?
The same as in the Arab countries, right? And that was a very important cause of the Arab Spring. So what happens to these people? Maybe they don't have unemployment insurance because they've never been employed. So they stay with their parents. What we're seeing in Europe is that you know, many young people are staying with their parents. And people are starting to talk about a lost generation. It's a shrinking generation. It's a generation that doesn't have a good prospect for the future, because even if they were to get a job for the next 20 or 30 years, they're going to have to pay the pensions for their parents. And, you know, there are fewer kids right now in Europe than there are parents. So it's a tricky situation also from the demographic point of view, looking down mm-hmm. the road for the next 15 or 20 years. But, Alex, you're absolutely correct in that at least there is a social safety net. So people are not dying, they're not starving in the streets of Europe. But of course, they're not happy either.
Well, indeed. But does that raise questions about the future of that social safety net, even just based on demographics and the shape of economies?
You're absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. This is a major challenge confronting aging societies, and Europe is aging so much faster than the United States.
Why is Germany in better shape than other countries in the EU?
Well, I think maybe there is. They definitely are. In fact, this was a country that during the recent crisis experienced just a very, very minor recession. They made the adjustments over the last 10 years. And intriguingly, it was a social democratic chancellor, Gerhard Schröder. I'd like to say something really nice about him because he was elected mostly by workers. And he actually introduced the most, the toughest measures to bring German manufacturing costs down so that the country would again be competitive, because Germany lost a lot of competitiveness in the 1990s as it tried to absorb East Germany, right? They did the homework, and here's the thing, the message for politicians. They did their homework during the boom years. You see, the problem is when you're trying to fix problems, right? When you're trying to introduce reforms in the middle of a crisis, you have to do that when things are going well. Mm-hmm. That's what the Germans did. So chapeau to them. I mean, they took action, corrective action, on time, right, before the next crisis.
And they're being, I guess, largely asked to help solve this problem.
Absolutely.
Right?
So this is a frugal country that saves a lot of money and that has a big trade surplus. So that's China. So it has to be countries like those that essentially help the countries that have big deficits and that need help right now.
And we're almost out of time here, but what then, assuming this crisis gets solved and Germany does help to fix it, what's in it for Germany? I guess it's keeping everybody together?
Well, not only that. So Germany, two-fifths of their exports go to the rest of Europe. German companies, if there's an infrastructure boom in Spain or in Portugal or in Greece, the first companies that get government contracts are German companies. So Germany has everything to win. Stability, business opportunities, and of course the Germans like going to all of these countries on vacation. So they should help them now with their troubles.
You have helped us understand what's been going on in Europe. Mauro Guillen, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Professor at the Wharton School here in Philadelphia. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. You can also check us out online. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.